You're listening to Echo Zoe Radio, episode number 14, originally released in June 2009 with guest Greg Kokel on Tactics for Defending the Faith. This episode is meant as a holding place on our server for the next episode. It wasn't posted for public use, but you're welcome to listen to it anyway. You can find the original at echozoe.com/14. Welcome to Echo Zoe Radio. I'm your host, Andy Olson, proprietor of EchoZoe.com. Thanks for joining me for this episode, which is number 14 for June 2009. This month, my guest is Greg Kokel of Stand to Reason. I had the opportunity some weeks back of interviewing Greg over the phone about his book, Tactics, A Game Plan for Discussing Your Christian Convictions. Now, this interview, actually, somewhat serendipitously, ties very well with the previous interview I did with Carl Johnson on moral relativism. Much of Carl's material comes from Greg's other book, Relativism, Feet Firmly Planted in Midair. And you'll notice that there is some material that's been mentioned in both the interviews that I did with Carl and now with Greg. So I hope you enjoy it. Well, today our guest is Greg Kokel. Thanks for joining us, Greg.
Glad to be with you, Andy. Looking forward to the chat.
I am, too. It's a privilege to have you. So the topic for our discussion today is your book, Tactics, A Game Plan for Discussing Your Christian Convictions. Mm-hmm. For those who are familiar with your ministry, Stand to Reason, the book is clearly a product of years' worth of work that you've been doing.
Yeah, that's right.
But for those who are unfamiliar with Stand to Reason, can you give kind of a little synopsis of what you do and what your focus is?
Yeah, I'd be glad to. It's timely to ask the question because 3 days ago we had our sweet 16 birthday.
Congratulations.
16 years ago and 4 days, we kind of more formally began the project, Stand to Reason. And our goal was to try to form an organization that would help Christians in an area, I think, where they needed a lot of encouragement. And that was in thinking more carefully about their convictions. Christians kind of broadly understand what Christianity is about, but they have a hard time, I think, explaining it to other people and defending it for other people. And consequently, especially as the culture gets more and more hostile to those who are followers of Christ, who actually follow him, you know, and hold the views that Jesus held about the world, it is more and more important for them to be able to navigate in that culture. And so in May of 1993, we started Stand to Reason. It started with me and then my coworker, Melinda Penner, who has been director of operations ever since and really is, as many people will know her as the enforcer who listened to my own radio show. And then we added more staff as time went on and more speakers. And the broad goal, Andy, was to train Christians to think more carefully about their convictions and to be able to navigate in conversations more effectively. Regarding the classical Christian notions and classical Christian values. And so basically our goal ultimately was to build a certain type of person. We didn't just want to throw information at people. Like a lot of apologetics organizations, and if people know the term apologetics, if your listeners know that, they'll have a general idea of the kind of thing that we do. We defend the faith. Mm-hmm. We train people to do that. But we didn't just want to throw information at them. We wanted to help produce a certain kind of person, and we call that an ambassador from 2 Corinthians chapter 5, verse 20. Paul says we're ambassadors for Christ. And a lot of our engagements with people who don't have our convictions, it's more like D-Day than diplomacy, and we want to reverse that. Mm-hmm. We want them to be ambassadors so they can navigate well. And so we try to build them in three areas: knowledge, which we call an accurately informed mind; wisdom, that's an artful method, the right use of knowledge; and character, which is an attractive manner. And so if we can build those three qualities into people that we come in contact with on a regular basis through our website or our speaking events or our podcast or our radio show, then we are building ambassadors that can make a difference, I think, in our culture. in a culture that's increasingly hostile. Certainly, it's gotten more hostile in the last 16 years. Mm-hmm. So that's kind of what we're all about. And the tactics book that you mentioned really focuses more on the middle quality, which is wisdom. We see there's a tactical element, how you maneuver in conversations. And everything that we do at Stand to Reason is really meant to help build followers of Christ to be better ambassadors, even when we're taking on the other side in a public event, so to speak, in a debate or a lecture. Like last week I was in Seattle at South Puget Sound Community College, a month before I was at Purdue University, and so we're willing to stand up there with the other side, but it's really more than anything else is to help other followers of Christ see what it looks like to adopt an ambassador motif as opposed to a combat motif mm-hmm. when we're dealing with those people who don't agree with us.
I'm just curious, were you influenced then by, you used to work with Dennis Prager, and he's got
I've been a guest many times on his radio show in the past when he was a local broadcaster here in Los Angeles. I was on his show over 20 times, mm-hmm. and that helped. You know, we built a relationship through that, and when I've been broadcasting now, I'm in my 20th year, and when I first got an opportunity to do the show, because I had started working with Dennis or being a guest on his show in the late 80s, I asked him for advice and whether he thought it was a good idea, and he encouraged me to go ahead with radio. Now, he's now national and a name that many, many people recognize, and mm-hmm. they should, because he's a sensational talk show host and a great conservative, thoughtful, and ethical man. And so there's so many things, even though he's Jewish, that we can trade off of. And I have used him as a model, as a broadcaster. So I have tried to make my show kind of like his, which is a show on ethics, values, and religion, and his has gone a lot more political, of course, in the last 10 years, but yeah. He focuses on those broader issues, and he does so with such a winsome and attractive style that I wish more Christian hosts, more Christians in the public eye, leadership types especially, would adopt his style. It's a great style, and so I figure, well, if I can be a model like he is of that kind of style, then maybe more in Christianity will be like that.
Yeah, the reason I ask is his driving principle is clarity over agreement.
Yeah, that's one of them. Yeah, he's actually got a number of clever aphorisms, I think, that are good ones. Clarity over agreement is one of his most famous. He also says, first tell the truth, then give your opinion, by which he means that every conversation, if it's going to be fruitful, has to at least be properly informed by the facts before someone gives their opinion on the facts. And if people start spouting their opinion and the facts are wrong, you know, then of course it's a dead-end conversation. Mm-hmm. So let's get our facts right first, and I think that's a real good policy. First tell the truth, then give your opinion.
Mm-hmm. Well, let's jump into tactics. You've already kind of mentioned the tactical approach, but why don't we talk a little bit more about what exactly the tactical approach is?
Yeah, what I want to do in this book, and we've been taking the tactical approach from our inception. In fact, this is something that was really part of my enterprise personally before Stand to Reason started, and it's something we naturally began working into our identity as an organization and what we're trying to do with people. And I mentioned earlier that we want our engagements to look more like diplomacy than D-Day. And that I think that looks something that's a great idea. But then the question is, what does that look like in a practical day-to-day interactions with those that don't agree with us? And so in the book Tactics, I want to teach people how to do that. And I want to advance, in part, the ambassador model that I just described. So there's knowledge, an accurately informed mind, wisdom and artful method, and character and attractive manner. All of that has to work together to be a good ambassador. Principally here in the book, we focus on the artful method. And what my goal is to teach how to navigate in conversations so that the follower of Christ stays in control in a good way, even though he has limited knowledge of theology or apologetics or philosophy or even of the other person's point of view. Mm-hmm. So the Christian may know nothing about how to answer challenges that people raise against what they believe. They could even be a brand new Christian, but it doesn't matter, because with these tactics, these maneuvers, they will be able to begin and enter into a conversation with people that can be very productive and with a large degree of protection. That is, they're not putting themselves at risk. Now, the subtitle of the book is A Game Plan for Discussing Your Christian Convictions. And that those words are carefully selected because, first of all, I want people to have a plan, and we actually sketch out a very precise plan by which they can enter into conversations, and there's a couple of steps. They're easy to follow. Anyone can follow them. And we've discovered that if you have a plan, it's easier to go forward. You're not as frightened because you know where to go, and you know when to stop. Basically, you have a sense, at least in general, of how to proceed. And when you have a sense, you have a bit more courage to step out. The second part of that description, a game plan for discussing your Christian convictions, is we are trying to advance a model, the ambassador model, which entails conversation, a back and forth, letting the other person talk and share their side, a requirement of listening on our side, so we can, in a sense, adjust ourselves to that individual person. Paul said that we should season our words with salt, as it were, so that we can know how to respond to each person. That's in the book of Colossians. And that's basically at the heart of this. We are taking the person where they're at. We are having a conversation with them, hopefully a conversation in which there's no tension, there's no anxiety, there's no awkwardness in the exchange, at least initially, no confrontation, no defensiveness, no discomfort, but rather a discussion that flows easily and naturally, mm-hmm. but a discussion in which the Christian is in control of the conversation. And that's the essence of our tactical approach, to be able to allow a follower of Christ to do that with, like I said, a tremendous degree of protection. They're not putting a lot at risk. They're not putting themselves out on the line, and they certainly don't have to know a lot, at least to start the process.
Mm-hmm. Well, the foundation of this tactical approach clearly is what you've come to call the Columbo tactic.
Yeah, that's right.
So what's the Columbo tactic?
The Columbo tactic, the name gives it away a little bit, mm-hmm. and a lot of people may remember this old TV show that was very popular years ago and still is popular. There's a lot of people who still watch Columbo on cable, because it's still around. Mm-hmm. And it's this is a guy who shows up. He's a detective, right? And he shows up at the crime scene with a trench coat on and a messed up hair and a cigar and a pad of paper, but no pen, so he's got to bum a pencil or a pen off of somebody. So this guy looks like he can't think his way out of a wet paper bag. He looks completely harmless, in utter disarray, but he's stupid, right? That's the way, completely harmless, but he's stupid like a fox because he's got a plan. And after poking around the crime scene and scratching his head and muttering to himself, he makes his trademark move. He rubs his brow, looks confused, and he said, there's something about this thing that bothers me. And then he says, do you mind if I ask you a question? And then he asks the question, he gets the response, all right, yeah, it's a simple question at the front end. It's an innocent one. He doesn't want to seem threatening. He's going to scare off his prey if he does. Mm-hmm. And for the moment, he seems satisfied, and then he turns on his heel, and he asks, just one more thing, raises his index finger. And then, of course, the just one more thing leads to another question and another, and soon they come relentlessly to the point of distraction and ultimately annoyance, And he says, I'm sorry, I know I'm driving you crazy, but I with the questions. But I can't help it, he says. It's a habit. And this is a habit that the Christian needs to get into. That is going on the offensive in an inoffensive way by using carefully selected questions to productively advance the conversation. Simply put, for tactical reasons now, I'm not saying we should never make our case, but for tactical reasons, we're at a tremendous advantage, especially if we're kind of neophytes or newcomers to this, of never making a statement when a question will do the job. Mm-hmm. There are a couple advantages to this approach. I mean, I'm not the only one who's used this. There's like the four deadly questions that somebody has come up with. Mark Cahill, for example, I think uses them, and I think they were around even before he started writing. And some others might have seen this. And indeed, it goes back, you know, 2,400 years ago to Socrates and this so-called Socratic method, which is asking questions. It's a great way of managing conversations. It's a great way of getting information. It's a flattering way of approaching people because you're drawing them out. You're letting them give their point of view, especially if they're sincere, you know. And this is what we want. Mm-hmm. We want sincere questions that create an atmosphere of conversation and also an atmosphere of education. So I had a guy once that called me on my own radio show, and he said, give me a book, recommend a book that will help me to understand Buddhism better. And I said, why do you want a book on Buddhism? He said, well, I got a friend who's a Buddhist, and I want to learn more about Buddhism so I can share my convictions with him. And I said, well, don't read a book on Buddhism. That's too much work. Mm-hmm. And chances are you're going to learn a kind of Buddhism he doesn't believe in anyway. What would be better is to take him out to Starbucks or something, buy him a latte, and ask him to tell you about his Buddhism. So there's a question, right? Mm-hmm. And there's a request that the very person that this fellow wanted to share his convictions with, share his Buddhism with him. So that's the guy. And so now you're in a conversation, and the Christian guy's not doing all the work reading and studying. He's just listening in a friendly conversation, so it's easier for him. Mm-hmm. The other guy is doing all the work, but he doesn't mind because he's talking about himself and his own beliefs. Mm-hmm. And so you can see how in an environment like that, there's great opportunity for conversation back and forth and back and forth, in which you can actually build the relationship with the person that you really want to make a difference in his life.
Yeah, and you gave a great example in the book early on of the witch in Wisconsin.
Yeah, that's right. We have a place in northern Wisconsin that I've been going to since I was a kid. I was raised in Chicago. Now I live out on the West Coast in Los Angeles, and we still make the flight most years. This year, we decided, for other reasons, we can't do it, so I'm kind of still crying in my milk right now because I'm not going to make my trip out to Wisconsin. And usually we spend about 2 or 3 weeks there, and it's a cabin in the woods on a lake, and we rusticate a bit and chop some wood, and I fish. Mm-hmm. And I like fishing. And I caught a very large smallmouth bass a couple years ago, and I was real proud of it, so I went to had pictures taken, and I need to have them digitized. This is before my digital photo days. And so we took them into the local overnight photo thing to get it digitized because I wanted to shoot this picture up on the screen at the church I was going to be teaching at the following week, you know, because I was really proud of the fish. Anyway, there's a lady that was standing there, a young woman, and she was, you know, helping us, and I noticed a large five-pointed star, a pentagram, hanging from her neck. And the pentagram is a cultic symbol, and I knew that, so I thought, well, I'm going to ask her a question about this. And I said, does that symbol, that star, have any religious significance? And she said, well, yeah, it does. The 5 points stand for earth, wind, fire, water, and spirit. Now, I was keyed in a little bit to that, you know, so, but I wanted a more specific question answered. I wanted to know whether it had religious significance to her, because obviously people wear crosses, it doesn't mean anything. Mm-hmm. So she said, yes, I'm a pagan. And, I mean, the admission shocked my wife, who first, you know, laughed and then caught herself and said, gee, I'm sorry, I didn't mean to be rude, but I'd never heard anybody actually admit it before, you know, and it was a surprise. And she said, well, you know, we're an earth religion, and went on to explain a little bit about it. And I said, so you're a witch then? She said, oh, yeah, uh-huh. And I said, oh, great, so now we're in a conversation, right? Mm-hmm. And I said to her, well, witches, as she explained to me, they respect all life. And I said, well, that would make you pro-life about the abortion issue. She said, no, I'm actually not. I'm pro-choice. I said, isn't that odd for a witch to be pro-choice? And she said, it is kind of, but... And then she made a qualifier. She said, I know I could never do that. I could never kill a baby. Now, these are her words, not mine. And mm-hmm. I believe that abortion takes the life of an innocent human being, but I don't usually use the term baby killing because it sounds to the other side like loaded rhetoric, and then it gets them on the defensive, which I don't want to do. So I use other terms about it, but I agree with that notion. But she's the one who's using it now, so I'm going to use her terminology now in the conversation. Mm-hmm. And this, by the way, Andy, is one of the advantages of being able to listen, learning. If you're using an ambassador model, which entails conversation and interaction, it requires that you listen. You're not always thinking about the next thing you're going to say. You're paying attention to what the person is saying because they're going to give you something much mm-hmm. of the time. And she just gave me something. She gave me her conviction that abortion is actually baby killing, even though she's pro-choice. Now, that's odd, isn't it?
Mm-hmm.
And so now I've got something to work with. I said, well, maybe you would want to kill a baby. She said she would never kill a baby. She wouldn't do it herself. I said, but maybe we should stop other people from killing babies. And she said people should have a choice. Now, that's an odd statement when you're talking about baby killing.
Uh-huh.
So I said, so I just followed through with that. Do you mean people should have a choice to kill babies? And she said, well, I think all things should be taken into consideration. I said, okay, tell me what kind of thing is a fair consideration for baby killing? And she immediately said, incest. Now, you notice, Andy, what she's doing is she's just rolling out the whole pro-choice slogan deal. Mm-hmm. And it's sounding weirder and weirder because she has already acknowledged that what we're talking about is not choice. You know, it's not reproductive freedom. It's baby killing.
Uh-huh.
And now, of course, when you think of baby killing in light of the slogans, it's bizarre. So she says incest, you know. And so then what we call trot out the toddler when we're talking about the abortion issue. Anytime somebody gives an illustration or a justification for abortion, you ask whether that justification would work for a toddler. And that's what I did. I said, now let me see if I understand you correctly. If I understand your view, you're saying that we can kill babies if they were conceived through incest. So if I had a 2-year-old here standing next to me, I should be able to, who was conceived through incest, and I should be able to take the life of that 2-year-old. And finally, she pauses for a moment. I finally get her thinking, which is my goal. I'll tell you this, and just I'll clarify this in a moment. And finally, she says, "You know, I'd have, I guess I'd have mixed feelings about that." And, I mean, it's a remarkable thing to say because I'm asking her about killing this 2-year-old standing next to me, and she merely says,
mixed
I'd have
feelings.
Mixed feelings about that. But she knows she's kind of caught because her moral rule that she's been trotting out so far, mm-hmm. you know, all of these choice, privacy, you know, children conceived through rape or incest, you know, these all justify killing a 2-year-old, and now she's having pause there. So I got her thinking. Now the line is kind of building up behind me, and you know that was the end of my opportunity, and I didn't go any further. And this brings me to another quick point I'd like to make, if I might, that my goal in these conversations is not to get to the foot of the cross. It is not my goal. Maybe it happens, maybe it won't. But I don't have that as a pressure. Since I'm an ambassador, not an evangelist, is the way I view myself, I'm just trying to make headway with whatever opportunity that God gives to me at that moment. Mm-hmm. Maybe that's a huge opportunity. It may be a small opportunity. I'm taking what I can get. And my goal, instead of trying to get people to the foot of the cross, my goal is going to try to just put a stone in their shoe. All right.
Mm-hmm.
I just want to get them thinking. When I talk to secular audiences, like over at Purdue, I tell them that. I said, here, I'm a follower of Christ, but I'm not here to convert you. I just want to put a stone in your shoe. I want you hobbling out of here kind of annoyed in a good way by something I've said. Because I think Christianity is worth thinking about, and I want you to think about what I have to say tonight. So I just want to put a stone into her shoe, and indeed I think I did that. And I accomplished my goal, and I'm out. And I don't have to be all guilty because I didn't tell her about Jesus. There wasn't enough time to get any meaningful discussion, quite honestly. This was the opportunity that God gave me. It was as far as I was able to get with the situation, so I counted it as a plus and let it lie. But what was instructive, though, about this broader conversation is that it was a perfect example, Andy, of using the ambassador model and the tactical approach. Because in this conversation, I actually asked 9 different questions. And since I had, for your audience, introduced the Columbo question tactic first, you can see how through every step of the way, as I'm moving through this, I am actually employing that tactic. I'm asking questions. I started the conversation out with a question. I use questions to move it along. I used it to exploit weaknesses that I saw in her view. I used it to gather more information. And if you noticed, the conversation was a genial conversation. We're not having a fight. We're not banging heads. There's no lines drawn in the sand. But I was in control the entire time, and she was doing all the work. So this gives you a little bit of a snapshot of the value of using a tactical approach, this game plan, to discuss your Christian convictions.
Mm-hmm. Well, as you get to really understand the tactical approach, you realize quickly that it can be very powerful. So what's the temptation then to abuse it, to turn it from being an ambassador to be more of a fighter, a soldier?
Well, a lot of the potential for abuse, it has to do with the tone in which people use it. And if you're trying to use questions to create an illegitimate gotcha moment, I do warn a little bit in the beginning about not just this tactic, but other tactics. They're very powerful, I think, and they can, when you understand how they work, they can be used to make people look really foolish. And that's not my goal. It's not my goal to make people look foolish. And by the way, one of the reasons it's easy to do so is because people blithely believe foolish and even stupid things. These are politically correct notions. They advance them with sloganeering. They have been socialized to believe these silly notions, but they have never thought about them. And the tactical approach forces people to think about them and to make sense of them, and when they're not able to do so, they can look foolish. And so I want ambassadors, Christian ambassadors, to be aware of that and not to go out of their way to try to stick people with these tactics, but rather I do want them to see the foolishness of their ideas. But I'm trying to be genial in the process and help them to see the waywardness of their ideas, just like this young lady. You know, I'm just asking these questions to get her thinking and whatever. And so when I'm using my questions, I'm trying not to use my questions in a, and we have model questions that we can talk about in a moment, but I'm not trying not to use them in a snide way and, oh yeah, well, what do you mean by that, you know, kind of thing, but rather to draw them out and to, there is a sense in some cases that I am setting them up. That is, I'm using my questions very carefully to get them to come to a point where there's an aha moment. There's like, oh wow, like she said, well, I'd have mixed feelings about that. Mm-hmm. Yeah, now she sees where her thinking leads. Oh, wait a minute, I can't go there. Well, what am I going to do now? That's what I want them to be thinking. Or gosh, I didn't realize that. Whatever. So when we are, in a sense, trying to show the people the natural and extreme or ridiculous consequence of their views, we want to be careful that we do this so it doesn't sound like we're doing it in a mean-spirited kind of way.
Mm-hmm. You mentioned model questions. That's probably a good time to go to those.
Okay. The Colombo tactic is a tactic that uses questions. The tactic itself, this is one of a number of tactics in the book. We have suicide, we have taking the roof off, we have just the facts, ma'am, we have Rhodes Scholar, we have steamroller. These are all different maneuvers. But the unique thing about the Colombo maneuver is that it represents the game plan. So it is the core tactic of the book. And then you kind of bring the other tactics into play at appropriate times, kind of within the context of this questioning approach to your engagement with other people. So there are, the way we break it down, there are three different uses, very specific uses, to the Colombo tactic, and there are three model-type questions, especially for the first two. The third one doesn't quite have a model question, but there are three specific model questions, or rather two specific model questions, that you can use to employ the Colombo tactic with. And the first use of Colombo, I'll just give you the three uses real quickly just to kind of set the stage. The first use is to gather information. The second use is to what I call reverse the burden of proof. Reverse the burden of proof. Mm-hmm. And the third use is to lead people to a particular destination. Notice when Colombo shows up on the crime scene, he doesn't know hardly anything about the situation. There's a dead body, that's it. He doesn't even know if it's natural causes or foul play, right? Mm-hmm. So, I mean, the presumption is foul play, or else they wouldn't make a TV movie out of it. But the point is, he's got to start gathering information. And so his questions are going to be geared at trying to get the lay of the land. He's going to try to figure out what's going on. When I talked to the witch in Wisconsin, there I was, starting ground zero. There was no momentum at all towards anything productive in a spiritual sense, right? I'm just there getting my photos done. And this is where we find ourselves in many conversations. Nothing's happening yet, okay? So then I notice something on her neck that might be a bridge to a spiritual conversation. I notice something that might be a bridge, and it turns out to be a piece of jewelry. So I ask a question about that is meant to gather information. And the question I ask is essentially, and this is the model question at this stage, what do you mean by that? What do you mean by that? Now, that's the model question, so it can be adapted, you know, as is appropriate for the circumstances. In this case, I see the gal with this jewelry, so I'm essentially looking at the jewelry and saying, what do you mean by that? When I ask her if that jewelry has any religious significance to her. Now, maybe she's wearing a T-shirt or something that has some provocative statement on it. And I say, what's that all about? You know, maybe it says, you know, it has fraternity symbols on it. I said, is that a fraternity or a sorority? Are you in where at? What school? You know, do you notice how this becomes the pretext for a genial conversation, interaction?
The icebreaker.
You know, sometimes the statement is a statement that is particular regarding some spiritual notion. Maybe you're already in a conversation. You listen to people overhear conversations, you know, and they say, I'm dead against this Prop 8 business in California about same-sex marriage. And so you might say, really, why is that? You know, what do you mean by that is the point. And you're drawing them out. Now we have to be careful when those kinds of things come up that we don't appear initially as hostile. But we're drawing them out just as a curiosity. People say there is no God. Well, that seems pretty straightforward, but it might be helpful to get a little more information. Because part of the deal here, Andy, is you don't want to start jumping and preaching at people right away. Even when they say something that seems pretty straightforward, you want to give them the chance to talk more about it. Because it makes you seem more gracious, more reasonable, more genial, friendly, and it gives you more information. So even something as simple as there is no God could be followed up with a kind of what do you mean by that question? For example, you could say, what kind of God don't you believe in? They might say, well, I don't believe in any God. You mean any personal God? Yeah, the personal God. It's organized religion that really bugs me, you know, they say. Maybe, you know, there might be some kind of God force or something, a yin and the yang or something like that. I mean, I'm open to that, but none of this, you know, this organized religion business with God looking down from heaven, condemning people and judging people, I just don't go for that. Now, notice when a person says something like that, they've given a whole lot more information. They may be open to the reality of some spiritual things, but they're not like a hardcore materialist like Richard Dawkins or Christopher Hitchens or Daniel Dennett, some of these guys that are writing now, the so-called new atheists. So now you got a little bit more information you can zero in. And there might be something that's said in the process of that conversation that encourages you to ask some more questions. You know, why don't you believe in, you know, like organized religion? What's the beef there? Mm-hmm. I mean, what would be the problem with it being organized? Why does that make it bad just because people are getting together with the same beliefs? Now, remember, I want to keep trying to ask these questions in a non-aggressive way, so I don't sound hostile, but I mean, that is a curiosity to me. Why would somebody want to reject something just because it's organized? Is disorganized religion better? I don't know.
Does the witch get together with her coven? Or?
Yeah, that's right. Well, that's the thing. You know, once they get together, hey, what would happen if you had a bunch of people who didn't believe in organized religion? And then they all decided to meet once a month for dinner and talk about their objections to organized religion. Well, they'd immediately be organized, and they'd have to disband, right, based on that conviction. So there's a little suicide.
Is that a suicide
going on
tactic?
Right there. So that's the first step, is that you're trying to gain information, and you're doing so by asking some variation of the question, what do you mean by that? If somebody says, you shouldn't push your morality on me. Well, I'm not... You know, I want to know more about what that objection entails. How exactly am I pushing my morality on you right now, or my views on you right now? So I'd want them to explain. Oh, well, you think you're right. Oh, that's what you mean by pushing. So anybody who, just for clarification, now, anybody who is talking about a point of view and thinks he's right is a person who's pushing his views on someone else. Yeah, that's it. Do you think you're right about that? Okay, now that's another question, but you can see it's a very different kind of question. This question now is challenging, which is okay at this point, because now something has come up that's a little bit odd, and I'm trying to poke a little deeper. Now I'm using Columbo in the third way. I am using Columbo now to lead somewhere, to make a point, and the point I'm making is there's a weakness in your view. And the weakness in your view is it works just as well against you as it against me. Does against me, and that in this case would be the suicide tactic that we can talk more about later. But now you can see how this starts to get more creative as you use these questions. But the simple way to start is to ask these questions that are questions meant to gather information, and the model question is, what do you mean by that? The second question, do you want me to go there now, or did you have something else you want to ask about the first?
Not that I can think of.
Okay, I realize I'm doing most of the talking here, but that's the advantage of you as a host asking questions, right? You get to ask the questions, and I do all the work.
Well, I'm still a bit of a novice at this. I've been doing it for about a year, and I've done... you're the 13th interview I've done.
Oh, okay.
And my philosophy is that it's your stage. And so
well,
I
that's
just want
nice
to
of you. But it does, it does point out, though... In a way, this is the way, you know, talk radio or talk programs work, where there's an interview going on, is one person asks the questions and the other person does the talking. And if you have a game plan for your questions, which clearly you do, then you can kind of sit back and enjoy. And that's the value of the Columbo tactic. So this is kind of an illustration in motion here, this entire show. So that
serendipitously, though,
the other person can explain their view. So the second use of Columbo is to what I call reverse the burden of proof. Now, this notion of burden of proof, I think people have a vague awareness of what it means, but they can't always put their finger on it. So let me make it real easy. The burden of proof is the responsibility mm-hmm. to prove something. The responsibility to give evidence or to give reasons for something. So the question then in any conversation is who has the burden or the responsibility to prove a point, to give evidence for it? And the answer to that is whoever makes the claim bears the burden.
Sounds fair.
Whoever says something so, they've got a responsibility to say why they think it's so, you know. And if the Christian is saying it's so, they say Jesus is the Son of God, or he's the only way of salvation, or God exists, or you have to believe in Jesus to be saved, or any of these kinds of claims, those are all say-sos. Those are all Christians making claims. Now, if a Christian makes a claim, it's his job to back it up. I mean, that's just common courtesy. Mm-hmm. But if the other guy makes the claim, it's his job or her job to back it up. It is not the Christian's job to refute it. All right? So if they say that the Bible's just a bunch of fables, now they're making the claim. If they say that Jesus, the rising Messiah, is just a repetition of some ancient myth that people believed in long before Jesus, and now they're just doing the same thing again, they're just copycat kind of thing, Well, now I know their view. I understand what they believe, but now it seems to me they have to do more than just tell this story. This is an example of what might be called bedtime story, all right? Mm-hmm. So they tell a story to put your view to bed. Christians have a point of view. Somebody's trying to dismiss the Christian's point of view, so they tell this story. Oh, well, this is, I can explain that. And then they tell this story. Well, they've got to do more than just tell a story and expect us to just fall asleep. They've got to give us reasons why we should take their story seriously. In other words, if they say it's so, then it's their job to tell us why it's so. They have to bear the burden of proof. And it's our job to push that burden of proof back on them rather than taking the responsibility ourselves to disprove them. And this, I think, is we do this too often. That is, we give them a free ride. We think they're making an argument when they're just making an assertion. They're just saying, oh, this is my opinion, is what it amounts to. But they're saying it aggressively, they're saying it with confidence, and they think that's all they need to do. And it's the end of issue. They just claim it. But they have to do more than tell a story. They have to give a rationale. And they can't just give an alternate explanation. When people give alternate explanations, they say, oh, I can explain that. That's like throwing their gauntlet into the arena. This is a thing that medieval knights used to do. They take their glove, the gauntlet, off, and they throw it in the arena. This is their challenge. When they throw the gauntlet down, they don't win just because they've thrown it down. They're only just then in the game, as it were. Mm-hmm. They have to then put up or shut up. They've got to fight. They've got to show what they've got. And by the same token, when someone else throws the gauntlet down, he can't claim victory just because he's opened his mouth and he's come up with some kind of clever story. He's got to show why the story is true. By the way, this is what's happened with, say, somebody like Dan Brown in The Da Vinci Code. I mean, his whole novel was at throwing the gauntlet down. He tells another story about the early church and how Jesus came to be viewed as the Son of God and all that stuff, and then claims that this was just a big fabrication or a fiction. What he doesn't do is he doesn't give any evidence that that's the case. He makes all of these exorbitant claims through the persuasive characters in the book and the movie. So it sounds great. People read it and say, oh, wow, what a persuasive case. Well, he hasn't made a case at all. Mm-hmm. He's just spun a story. It's a fiction, for goodness sake. In fact, everything about that book is fictitious. Even the things that he claims are fact in the little note that he has at the beginning of the book. What he doesn't do is he doesn't step up to the plate and give us real factual evidences why we should take seriously any of this stuff. Priory of Sion, Jesus married to Mary Magdalene, them having a baby, the fabrication of all the information about Jesus' life prior to Council of Nicaea, all that fabrication, you know, that, Jesus...
Well, it's a pretty typical conspiracy theory.
Yeah, that's right. Actually, what his theory was the Council of Nicaea was the working out of a conspiracy to create an ordinary man, to create a God-man out of Jesus when he was just an ordinary man. So, I mean, the evidence is profuse and profound against his entire thesis, but he never produces any evidence on his behalf. So this is a big example of what we're talking about here. So with the first use of Columbo, we are gathering information, and we use this model question, what do you mean by that? In the second use of Columbo, we are reversing the burden of proof. So we are asking the other person to prove their point. And the model question here is, now how did you come to that conclusion? Or some variation. What is your evidence for it? Or what reasons do you have for that point of view? Now, it's their job, as I've said, to come up with those reasons. And if they don't come with those reasons, then there is no reason then for us to take the point of view seriously. They don't get credibility just because they say it. That's it. Now, sometimes people give them credibility, or they consider their notions credible because the way they say it is forceful or clever. And this is the case with a lot of critics. And, of course, this is what happened with the book The Da Vinci Code. It was forceful and it was clever, being written in this narrative style. And so many people were persuaded by it, even though there was no evidence that was actually given for the point of view. And so this is a requirement that the other people, put up or shut up. They make their own case. They don't require us to defeat their case for them. And this question is very, very, very valuable at this point. How did you come to that conclusion? It's the one that makes or breaks their view. Now, I do tell people, by the way, Andy, and I think it'd be good to mention that here for your audience, is that they should not be surprised when they ask either of these questions, what do you mean by that, or how did you come to that conclusion, if they get what I jokingly call Simon and Garfunkel. Remember those two guys from the 60s and early 70s? They're still around, by the way, but they're great songwriters, and one of their famous songs from the past was called Sounds of Silence. And that's what you're going to hear a lot of times when you ask, what do you mean by that, or how'd you come to that conclusion? You're just going to get silence. And people maybe just look at you in a mystified way because they've never been asked that question before. And they've never had to answer it. And in many cases, they've never thought about it. And this is especially surprising in the first case because you figure if somebody says a statement, you know, they must know what they're talking about. But I had a girl once, a waitress, who said to me, you know, we've gotten off a start on a little conversation there around the table in the restaurant, and she said, all religions are basically the same. And I asked a variation of the what do you mean by that question. I asked her, in what ways are they all basically the same? Now, you think somebody who says they're all basically the same has thought about this and knows what similarities that seem to impress her. She was totally mute. She was dumbfounded. She couldn't say anything. In fact, she was silent for so long with this simple question that it started to get embarrassing. I was feeling uncomfortable. And so I'm, you know, passing on alternatives or suggestions. Well, maybe it's the golden rule or something like this, trying to help her out a little bit. But here she had made this statement and she had never really thought of it. I suspect she had used statements like that to stonewall Christians in the past, and she hadn't had to go any further because they didn't know what to do with it. I just simply asked her what she meant by that. Give me some examples of the kinds of things that are common in all religions. And she just couldn't. And especially when you say, how did you come to that conclusion? In other words, when they have a point of view that something is so, then defending it. Because you're assuming, in a, I think, a charitable way, that they've actually thought about their views and they came to a conclusion. And they haven't just emoted or been, you know, influenced by some other person who convinces them without reasons. But in many cases, I'd say most cases, you have people that are just emoting or they've been socialized to believe certain views and they've never given them any thought whatsoever. And the minute you ask for the reasons, they are completely at a standstill. So in both of these questions, you can ask them graciously and with genuine curiosity. And it's amazing just in asking the questions, you can make headway because you're forcing people to make good on their own ideas in two different ways with no pressure on yourself. Go ahead.
Yeah, that's going back to what we had talked about earlier about it being such a powerful approach to discussion that you got to be careful because you're going to quickly see that people haven't thought those things through yet.
That's right. It can be embarrassing for them very quickly on. And so if you seem the least bit, say, hostile or cagey or like you're trying to, all right, I'm setting you up and I'm going to get you so I can get a little notch in my spiritual belt here for, you know, one down, 500,000 more to go or whatever, you know, that's not going to come across well. I might mention, by the way, at this point, that there is to some degree a liability to these questions. There's a move that can be made against the Christian who is using these questions that the Christian needs to be aware of, and it's a kind of a burden of proof reversal. So I call it the professor's ploy because a lot of times professors will use something like this. Mm-hmm. So you have professors that have it as a goal in their class to destroy the convictions of any Christian that signs up for his course, you know, and this happens all the time, and it's actually getting much, much more aggressive. And Christians get picked off left and right by this. And so they spend their time, whenever opportunity arises, to attack Christianity, even though the lecturer of the class has nothing to do with that. And so the professor will say something like, well, the Bible's just a bunch of fables, you know, he'll shoot this out in the class. And somebody in the class, they're going to be Christians there, and they don't want to let this lie, and they want to be faithful to Christ, and so they're going to stand up and oppose the professor, and they raise their hand and stand up, and then they have a head-to-head duel. And this is right-hearted, but it's wrong-headed, in my view. Mm-hmm. Because it violates a basic rule of engagement, and that is you never make a frontal assault on a superior force in an entrenched position. You know, it's just like, this is stupid.
Yeah, he's just baiting
like,
you.
Like Custer's Last Stand, but the, what was that other one, Third Day of the Battle of Gettysburg, you know, the Pickett's Charge, you know, it's a slaughter. So I suggest instead you use your tactics. You raise your hand and ask a question at this point. And here's our first question. What do you mean by that? So you ask the professor to explain his view. So let him explain it, and off he goes. And then after he's done, you could raise your hand a second time. Now, how did you come to that conclusion? See, these are the kind of questions that any student could ask, and he's totally within his rights to do so. It's just exactly the kind of thing that's appropriate for a student who's trying to learn. Mm-hmm. So it's not a power struggle. So the professor, though, and here comes the ploy, the professor, though, may figure out what's going on. He might think, oh, that's a Christian who's sandbagging, you know, with these questions. So he might say, oh, you must be one of those Christians who believe the Bible is the Word of God. All right, fine. I got a couple of minutes. Why don't you stand up and tell the rest of the class why you think the Bible is not a bunch of fables, but really the Word of God. Go ahead. Well, now he's put the Christian on the spot, right? Mm-hmm. And he's reversed the burden of proof. He's making the Christian prove the point, or I should say disprove the point that he has made. And of course that's cheating, isn't it? Because mm-hmm. the Christian hasn't made any statements. He's only asked questions, and if you only ask questions, you don't have to bear any burden of proof whatsoever. He's the one who's trying to dodge the challenge. And this is where I tell people, when someone tries to reverse the burden of proof on you, don't take the bait, right? Rather, say something like this. Well, Professor, you don't actually know my view because I've never said it. And frankly, it doesn't matter here because I'm not the teacher. You are. I'm trying to learn. I'm just one of the students, and that's why I'm asking you questions. So don't make him force the burden of proof back on you when you haven't made the claim. Let the professor defend his own view. In fact, insist on it. At least request it of him, and do not be pressed into the position of defending a view that you are not expressing. And if the professor says, well, maybe you didn't say anything, but it's obvious by your questions, then I'd respond, there's nothing obvious by my questions. You're making assumption. Well, okay, tell us plainly, are you a Christian or not? And I said, frankly, I'd rather not share that. None of your business. You know, you don't have to go any further than you want to go. You are in charge of what you say. I said, I don't have to say anything, you know. Frankly, I don't want to answer that question. What I do want to do is I want to try to get an education from my professor and clarification on the things that he said. So I want to know what
you're probably paying a lot of money for that, too.
Sorry?
I'm sorry, you're probably paying a lot of money for that, too.
Exactly. This is precisely. Professor, this is what I'm paying my tuition for. You're not paying me tuition, I'm paying you tuition. So I want to know, what are your reasons for saying that the Bible is a bunch of fables, that's all? Or maybe you want us all to take this all on faith. No, you don't say that. So that's the ploy. That's the professor's ploy that you want to try to avoid.
So what do you do then if he maybe takes the tactic of turning Columbo back around on you?
Well, I do talk about that in the book. What happens if they make play turnaround? But think of the Columbo questions so far. The Columbo questions are, what do you mean by that? And how did you come to that conclusion? Those are questions that are meant to draw a person out for him to lay his whole point of view on the table. I tell people, now remember, in the case of the professor is trying to dodge his own responsibilities if he's asking that question in the illustration that we just used. And if he says, well, what do you believe? Well, that's the first Columbo question. But in that circumstance, since he's trying to dodge his own beliefs and he's trying to put me on the spot in an illicit way, then I'm probably not going to answer that. I'm going to make him answer his own questions. But in general, if people use the Columbo on me, do I want to tell them what my view is? Sure. I'd love for somebody to ask me what I mean by that, what my view is. Do I want to tell them how I came to those conclusions? Sure, I'd be glad to, because I've thought through my own views. I know how I came to the conclusions. I think the views are well defended. So I have no angst at all about fielding those kinds of questions. They're inviting me to make the case for my own view. And I presume if they're asking the question, they're willing to listen. So I'm not forcing my views on them. In fact, if in that conversation, Andy, they said, well, you're forcing your views on me, I said, well, you asked me.
You asked the question.
You asked the question. I'm answering the question. What do you want? I think sometimes, you know, even if somebody's ambiguous about a hostile view they have towards you and you ask the question, what do you mean by that? Do you mean this or do you mean that? And they say, hey, you're trying to change my words. I said, no, I'm not. That's why I'm asking the questions. I'm not trying to change your words. I'm asking you. I'm giving you the chance to clarify precisely so I don't misunderstand your view. And if you don't want to clarify, that's your own business. But there's an ambiguity here, and I'm just trying to figure it out. I don't want to misrepresent your view. And that's one of the advantages of the first question, that you don't find yourself in what's called a straw man situation where you are misrepresenting what the other person actually holds to be true. I want to talk about the third use. I haven't talked about that very much. I just hinted at it at the beginning. But there's a third use to Columbo that is a little bit more advanced. But there's another value to the second uses, the first and second use of Columbo. I call this getting out of the hot seat. And I go into detail on this in the book. Just to show how flexible these first two questions are, the hot seat is the place that a person finds themselves when they are, you know, talking with somebody else about, say, spiritual things, and it turns out that the other person knows a whole lot more about whatever it is they're talking about than you do. And especially for people who are beginning, you know, you just got a couple of ideas, you want to make a little headway, and that's great, you get going, but then maybe, say, you know, you're trying to talk about the historical evidence of the resurrection or something like that, and then it turns out you realize you're talking to a PhD in history who doesn't agree with you, and they think they know a lot more, and maybe they do, and then all of a sudden they're hitting you with all this information, all this so-called facts, and you don't know how to deal with it. You're a little overwhelmed by it all. And so, you know, that's when you start thinking, gee, I wish I would have never opened my mouth, you know, because look, I got myself in trouble. Well, this is where your first two questions can help. They can get you out of the hot seat, which is where you just found yourself. And here's what it looks like. What you do is you practice what I call a little conversational Aikido. You know, Aikido is that self-defense where you use the other person's energy against them, right? You don't try to push them back, you let them come towards you, and then you use that energy in there against them. So the way it looks is, it's basically you're saying, you want to beat me up? All right, come on down, is what you're saying. And so it looks something like this. Wow, you know a lot more about this than I do. Can you do me a favor and just, I'd like to learn something from you, because I know we disagree, but you know, maybe I'm wrong, and you got a lot of information. So could you please slow down? You're asking them to slow down. You get a piece of paper out. You say, I want to get your ideas down clearly. So could you tell me exactly what your point is, what your view is, what you mean by that? That's the first question. Mm-hmm. And then give me your reasons for it. How'd you come to that conclusion? That's the second question. So you ask them to give you the information and the rationale. You're inviting them now to come forward. And by the way, when you do that, do you notice how the momentum shifts in the conversation? Because just a few moments ago, if you're in that situation, who's in control when you're being in the hot seat?
He is.
The other guy's in control, right? And you're feeling all off balance. The minute you say, you know, you slow down and give me the same information, but give me the reasons for it, now you're back in control of the conversation. You're out of the hot seat real quickly. And then you say, after you give me this information, and now here's the magic words, okay, then let me think about it. Then let me think about it. Now you think about this, Andy. If you were in a situation like that and you ask the first two questions and they then give you all this information and you say, okay, I want to think about this, do you have any obligation to try to refute him at that point?
Not at all.
No, you're off the hook. you already told them, you know, I'm stupid, you're the smart guy, give me an education, and let me chew on it a bit. Mm-hmm. Now, here's the next step. Now, so now you're completely off the hot seat. You're getting a great education. All the pressure's off, but you're still engaged, which is key. You didn't tuck your tail between your legs and, you know, head for the hills. You're still engaged. That's the key part. Now, what do you do afterwards? Well, you do what you told him you were going to do. You think about it. You got your notes there. You got his view and the reasons as he gave them, such as they are. Now you think about it, but you're thinking, you go to our website, str.org, Stand to Reason's website, Stand to Reason, STR. So you go to str.org, or you can go to some other website, or you can go to other books that you have, or you can call our radio show or whatever, or others. I mean, the Christian has access to information quickly, but they don't have access to information quickly when somebody's beating them on the head. So on your own, at your leisure, when the pressure is off, then you could do your homework, and you could figure out whether this guy's got a point or not. You can help somebody else help you see what's wrong with it. And so this is something, by the way, anybody can do, no matter how timid or shy or retiring or whatever they think they are. Basically, what you're doing is you're saying to the big, tough person who's beating you up, you're saying, oh, you want to beat me up? It's okay with me. Just do it slowly and thoroughly, basically, is what you're saying. And this is a sensational way to get an education, because now you got the stuff on paper, and then when you go home, you can, you know, put it in a computer file, do your research, paste it all in there, print it out, now you got it. You got your own little homework done on that particular question, and you know it's really part of you now because you've worked with it. It isn't because I've taught it to you, like said it at you, or you just read it in a book, but now when you're working with it in the context of a little conflict that you had with somebody, that really helps it to stick. And the next time around, when another issue comes up with somebody who knows a whole lot more about it than you do, you say, wow, you seem to know a lot more than I do about this. Could you slow down a little bit, please, and tell me what specifically you believe, your point, what that is, and then tell me your reasons for it, and I can write it down, and then you let me think about it. And then you've got another one that you work with. And so it's not going to be too long before you have most of the kinds of things that people are going to bring up in conversation.
It ties in really well with what you've talked about in the book and on the radio show and in your materials, the idea of replaying the tape, that even if it's not necessarily that they're making claims that you don't know how to tackle, just going back and thinking, how could I
have
done this differently?
Yeah, I do that all the time, Andy. It has been such a tremendous benefit to me where I think about... See, if you want to improve your Columbo tactic, and I will get to the third point of Columbo in just a minute, but if you want to improve in your Columbo tactic, it's hard to improve right in the middle of a conflict or conversation. That's tough because that's when the pressure's on. And people say, gosh, Coakley, you're so quick on your feet, you know. How do you love those things? Well, I say, I'm not quick on my feet. I just did my homework. And so I know what's coming up, and I know what to say when things happen. So in order to appear like you're quick on your feet, it's easier to work on the stuff when there's no pressure. And there are two times when the pressure is off. The pressure is on in the middle of the conversation. The pressure is off either before the conversation or after the conversation. So if in either time you can think about how you might respond when that issue comes up, you can kind of brainstorm options. Or maybe after you've had an encounter, you can say, oh, that didn't go so well. Gee, how could I have done better? What questions could I have asked? This happened to me just actually a couple of months ago when I had just been teaching on Columbo at a church, and I walk out into the foyer right after the sermon, and somebody confronts me immediately. It was a non-Christian with a statement, and I dropped the ball just immediately. I didn't use my tactics the way I did. Now, I recovered and started getting into my Columbo tactic as it worked out. But even a guy like me who's been trained in it, you know, and then when I was just teaching on it, I dropped the ball immediately. So what I did is I did some reflection afterwards as to how I could have better handled that circumstance. And now then I practice a little bit. What questions could I have asked? Oh, here they are. And then I kind of mentally practice it. Or I tell people about it. Oh, here's what I did, and here's what I could have said. And just the act of talking it through a little bit more fixes that more in my mind. But anyway, I've talked a lot about the first two steps. Let's talk about the third step of Columbo, okay? The third step of Columbo is when you use questions to lead someone to a different location. Okay, it takes you more on the offensive, but in an inoffensive way, and it's a different kind of question you're asking. It's sometimes called a leading question. It's taking someone somewhere. I want folks to think of themselves here like an archer shooting at a target, and the questions are like the arrows. The target's going to be different situations. Sometimes the goal will be to defeat what you think is a bad argument or a flawed point of view. And the questions then will be aimed at that purpose. Or you may want the questions to indirectly explain or advance your own ideas. Sometimes the questions will set up the terms of the conversation to put you in a more beneficial position for your next move. I mean, there's lots of different variation. But the goal is to take people somewhere. Now, what's different in the third question from the first two questions is that in the first couple of cases, you don't need to know anything but the questions. That's why they can be used by anyone. They're the core of the game plan. That the first two steps are easy. They allow anybody to get in motion. So you don't have to hit home runs. You don't even have to get on base, as far as I'm concerned. You just need to get up to bat. And those first two questions allow you to do that and get you into play, and then you can see where the Lord takes it. Okay. The third question, though, the third use of Columbo entails that you use questions in a deliberate fashion, and therefore you have to know what you are trying to accomplish. So if you see a liability in someone's view, then you use a question, not a statement, to exploit it. And I did that a little earlier in our conversation. I'm trying to remember the exact example of it, but I guess
the trotting out the toddler.
Yeah, trotting out the toddler would be one example of that. The another one was when people said, "I don't believe in God because I don't really believe in organized religion," and why not? What if people organized? What if a whole bunch of people like you who didn't believe in organized religion got together for dinner on a regular basis to talk about it? Well, that would be organized, wouldn't it? What then? You know, so there's kind of like it's a little jab at their view. It's a question that is meant to challenge the view and show that there might be something wrong with the view. And there's lots of ways that this can be done. And I give a number of examples in the book exploiting a weakness or a flaw. For example, I had a conversation with a guy, and this is actually an example of the suicide tactic too. But told me he didn't believe that it was right. We were having a conversation about homosexuality, and he said, "You know, you Christians are nice people, you know, by and large. But then pretty soon you start judging people." And I recognized immediately, just from my experience here, that he had kind of made a blunder, but he didn't know it. And so I'm going to try to exploit the blunder with a question. And I say, "What's wrong with that, Gil? Why is it? What's the problem?" He said, "Well, it's wrong to judge." Okay, now he's made a statement. And the irony is that when you tell somebody that it's wrong to judge, the statement itself is also an example of a judgment, isn't it? And so I just pointed that out to him. I said, but I did with a question. I didn't say, "You're judging me right now." That would have been a statement. And that would have pointed out what he's doing wrong. He's doing the same thing he's telling me not to do, but with a statement, and that's kind of a dead-end tactic. So instead I said, "Gil, if it's wrong to judge, then why are you judging me right now?" Now the ball's back in his court, isn't it? And he's got to respond. But he's got to respond in light of this kind of strange bind that he's gotten himself into. And so he's trying to regroup a little bit, and he's trying to think of ways to get around it, and he can't get out of that for obvious reasons, it seems to me. And so he says, "Well, I guess it's okay to judge, but," and then he has a glimmer of hope, you know, "but you can't push your morality on other people. If you push your morality on other people, oh, that's wrong." Now, you're chuckling for good reason, because you see that hasn't helped him, has it?
He's climbing out of one hole and getting into another.
Exactly. This is exactly right. So I, you know, of course, I recognize this. I know that he hadn't improved his lot at all, and I asked him, "Well, how?" Then I said, "Gil, is that?" Notice here's, now this is an information question. "Is that your morality?" He just said, "It's wrong to push your morality on other people." Now, I want to use Columbo number 3. That is, I want to use a question to lead him, to show him something, and what I'm going to show is that there's a weakness or flaw in his view. But in order to get to a position where I can ask the third question, I have to ask another clarifying question. So he says, you shouldn't push your morality on other people. I ask, is that your morality? Now, it's obvious it is, but I want him to say it so he doesn't have any way out here. So this is a little bit of a setup and destroy, but it's not being done in a mean way. He says, yes, that's my morality. And again, he does it so blithely, he doesn't realize he's walking right into this trap that his own view has set for himself. And he said, yes, that's my morality. And so I had the question, I think by now is obvious, then why are you pushing your morality on me right now? And once again, he's back into his head scratch and chin rubbing kind of pose, trying to figure out what the heck happened. And he made a couple of false starts. He's trying to rephrase it, you know, and he can't get going, obviously. And he gets real upset, you know, frustrated, and he says, I can't, it's not fair, he said. He said, I can't find a way to say it in which it sounds right. He said, well, he thinks I'm playing a word trick on him. I said, Gil, it's not a trick. It doesn't sound right because it isn't right. You're doing the very thing that you're telling me not to do, and you can't avoid that. It's the nature of what you're doing. By the way, that's what happens almost every single time a relativist type complains about Christians having moral views that they think should apply to other people. Mm-hmm. Because that's pushing your morality on me, you know. But
the old political statement, you can't legislate morality.
Yeah, what a bunch of nonsense. Every law is a legislation of morality, every single one of them. In fact, if it's not legislating morality, it's not a good law.
Exactly.
It's just using power to get one's own way, and that's not
immoral.
Proper use of the law. So anyway, I asked this final question, and he's doing the same thing, and it becomes clear in a situation like that that this is the way. This is a confusion. That's a deep confusion that people have. It's very easy to do when people are promoting relativism, and you know, or like the guy says, well, you think you're right, you know. I said, well, don't you think you're right? This is the way people do with tolerance all the time. You're intolerant. Well, what does that mean? What do you mean by that? There's our Columbo question. Well, you think you're right. Well, of course I think I'm right. I wouldn't be believing what I believed if I didn't think I'm right. But what about you? Don't you think you're right? Of course. Well, then why is it when I think I'm right, I'm intolerant, but when you think you're right, you're just right?
I love that Jake's Bar thing that you encountered.
Oh, recently. Yeah. That is really something else. It's on my Facebook, but it's a picture of something, and now I'm actually looking for it here on my desk. I took the picture out, but it's a picture of something that I saw on a bar, like on the window of a outside window of a bar in Olympia, Washington. Now, Olympia is a very liberal town, and it's also very, well, the phrase they use is queer friendly. That is, they are very much in favor of promoting homosexuality and that kind of stuff, you know. So so they've got a poster that's sitting out here. It is, I just found it in my iPhoto, and here's what the poster says. I can't read all of it because some of it's there's an unmentionable there, a naughty word. It says this: Jake's is a hate-free queer bar. We welcome everybody unless you are homophobic, transphobic, racist, sexist, heterophobic, thief, drug dealer, violent, bigot, or basically a jerk is what it says, but it doesn't use that word. And then it says, if none of these apply to you, you're welcome. Isn't it interesting? We are a hate-free bar. We welcome everybody except, and then they have these people who hold these ideas. We're going to use the worst, most unpleasant name we can think of to describe you. And we aren't going to let you in. It says, if none of these apply to you, welcome, big exclamation points, and have a fabulous time, exclamation point. And then it has this at the bottom. And this is the coup de grace, Andy. The staff at Jake's cares about you. If you feel that someone here is compromising our safe, hate-free space, please don't hesitate to let one of us know. Of course, thanks to Jake Staff. Now, of course, the subtext there is, and we're going to throw him out on his ear, you know. So this is the hate-free environment. These are the tolerant folks, and it just shows that political correctness is not hate-free and it's not tolerant at all. They are tolerant of everybody who is just exactly like them, and anybody else is not welcome. You know, it's just that simple. The irony of this is that it's plastered on the window as you walk up. You know, and anybody who wants to go to my Facebook can see it there. You know, it's just quite a stunner. But this, by the way, is an example of another tactic. This is an example. Now, if I were to exploit this problem that we see on this poster for Jake's Bar, I would use the Columbo tactic to exploit it. But it's actually, and I would be exploiting it with a different tactic, and that tactic is called the suicide tactic. Now, what the suicide tactic does is if you understand how it works, it allows you to recognize when views are self-refuting, and that is, they for some reason they beat themselves up just as badly as they beat anybody else up. All right, and this was an example of it, and so was the illustration I gave you about Gil. And what's happening here is they say we are hate-free and we are tolerant, essentially. And then he says we don't accept anybody who's intolerant. But, of course, their list indicates that they are completely intolerant of a whole bunch of other people. Now, I understand that this list might describe people who are genuinely having vice, you know, like thieves and drug dealers and violence and bigots and stuff like that. But some of these other things are just, you know, you have a view about homosexuality and you're called a homophobe. The point here isn't that all of these are good things. The point here in there is that they are not really being tolerant because they are showing that they don't tolerate certain types, but that's exactly what those on the other side are doing, the ones they're complaining about. They have their own list of things that they don't tolerate as well. So one's not any better than the other in the tolerance category. They just have different lists. That's it. So their view then, or their poster in this case, self-destructs. I'll give you some example of that. That's the suicide notion, self-destruction. Very clear examples. There is no truth. Well, is that statement true? If it's true, then it's false. You know, that kind of thing. It's obvious that if there is no truth, then that statement can't be true. But if we can't, it's not true, then we don't have to take it seriously to begin with. It self-destructs. There are no absolutes. Oh, really? Is that an absolute?
Hmm.
No one can know any truth about religion. Oh, is that? How did you come to know that truth about religion? Talking about God is meaningless. What does that statement mean? You know, that isn't that a God, talk about God? So there are lots of things that, like that, that are religious ideas that turn out to be self-refuting. So that's the concept, and then we look at particulars. Actually, the first one is one of the biggest ones. There is no truth, and it is stunning how many people actually think this is a profound statement. You find it all the time on college campuses, and it bewilders me as to why this is such a convincing kind of concept to people, because it's obviously false.
Go ahead. I pointed that out before, too, and then I get what you called the Simon and Garfunkel.
Yeah, that's right. Well, if you ask people, is that true, when they say there is no truth, and you say, is that true, then you get the Simon or Garfunkel. What they may follow up with, though, is kind of like, oh, come on, that's just a trick. That's a word trick. They're going to brush you off. But it isn't a trick at all.
Mm-mm.
It's an attempt to take their view seriously. Because when they say there is no truth, what do they want me to think about that statement? Do they want me to accept it or reject it? I think they want me to believe them. But the minute I try to believe them, I realize that I can't believe them. The minute I accept it as true, it defeats itself. So it's not a trick. It's not a sophomoric kind of response. It's a genuine and legitimate kind of response to what turns out to be a sophomoric statement. There is no truth. And I've actually done, you know, I've done debates on this with people in the university, with professors who are PhDs, you know, saying that there is no truth. But what the heck? And they're drawing a paycheck to teach kids what? That there is no truth? Anyway.
Class dismissed.
There are a lot of examples. I know we're running a little short on time here, but there are a lot of examples like that in the book that show how you can use the suicide tactic to undermine some notions that are very popular now, but just don't work. Science is the only thing that gives reliable truth is another one. Oh, I don't believe in religion. I believe in science. Because if you can't prove it by science, you can't trust it. Well, the question could be asked, can the statement that they just made be proved by science? That is, if you can't prove it by science, you can't trust it. Well, that's a statement that they believe is true, and therefore they trust. Well, that means the statement itself must have been proved by science. But of course, science doesn't prove that only that science alone proves things. That's something else entirely. And so that statement turns out to be a self-refuting statement or a statement that commits suicide. It's like this can be put another way, and I have this in the book. It's like a person who says, I don't believe in religion. Why not? Well, there's no scientific evidence for it. Well, then you shouldn't believe in science either. Why not? Because there's no scientific evidence for it. There's no scientific evidence for science. Once you know the methods of science, then you can begin gathering scientific evidence for other things, but the methods of science are not proven by science. Mm-hmm. It's a self-refuting notion.
Well, as far as I'm concerned, I mean, there's no time limit, but I didn't want to keep you too long.
Well, I think this has been a good kind of synopsis of the core of what tactics is all about, and I hope that your listeners are going to, you know, get after this kind of thumbnail sketch or this. I think it's more than that. I mean, a good core insight or information about the tactics book. I hope that they go and grab a copy of it and read it for themselves and learn some of the other tactics that I mentioned, like steamroller and suicide and taking the roof off and just the facts, man, and road scholar, and really. Begin to practice them in their lives, I think they're going to find that they are going to be so much better as ambassadors, and it's going to be so much easier for them to do that, too.
Yeah, definitely agreed. Before I let you go, did you want to, you've mentioned your website and the book, of course, did you want to plug anything else? Or?
Well, let me mention the website one more time, because there's 900 pages of information on our website, and that's a whole lot.
There is.
Our website is simply str.org. It's the acronym for Stand to Reason, STR. And there are so many things that you can find there. Actually, a lot of stuff you can get for free just on tactics. So if somebody types in the word tactics, they'll be able to download quite a bit that we have there just for anybody to read. The best thing, of course, is to get the book. It's very inexpensive. They can get it through our website if they want. And also my own radio show is available there. There's a radio button they can hit, and then all the information about podcasting is available. So I also have another book that I've written, and that is on relativism. It's subtitled Feet Firmly Planted in Midair, and I co-authored that with Frank Beckwith. He's a philosopher, and there's a lot of the tactical approach that's built into that book as well. So all the things that we do kind of entail that notion. And I think your listeners might benefit from both of those. The third thing I want to mention is that we have really done some very careful work on the pro-life issue, and we have developed materials that pro-lifers can use, I think, very easily to engage those who don't agree with them in a very, very sound way. In fact, these materials are so powerful, the arguments, that lots of people's minds have been changed on this issue, and even when students say, grab this material and use it, work it into their debates, that they not only win the debates hands down, but they also sometimes even win over the person who's debating against them on this issue. The arguments are that powerful. The material is called Making Abortion Unthinkable, The Art of Pro-Life Persuasion. I'll say that again, Making Abortion Unthinkable, The Art of Pro-Life Persuasion, and I also have a smaller booklet entitled Precious Unborn Human Persons, and another titled called Common Ground, how to basically tactically maneuver just on the abortion issue. So all of that is available on our website, too, and people should, we encourage them to take a look at it.
Yeah, very much that. Abortion stuff is actually how I first encountered Stand to Reason myself,
oh.
And it absolutely is the most powerful stuff that I've ever encountered on the pro-life. And I'll link to that, and I'll link to your website, and definitely stand behind that myself.
Sounds great.
But thank you so much for your time today, and thanks for coming on my show, and it's been an absolute pleasure to have you.
Thank you, Andy, and I've enjoyed it. I appreciate you sharing me with your audience.
And you mentioned Facebook. I'm one of your, probably you got like 1,700 friends now on there.
Something like that, yeah.
Something like that. So that's kind of a fun one, too, is just staying in touch with people and seeing how they're doing.
Right, yeah. And obviously, I can't stay personally in touch with 1,700, but if people want to get a little bit more of a peek into my personal life, that's the best place. And sometimes things are posted there that they can't find anywhere else, like that photo. About Jake's bar. I posted that about 2 weeks ago. Of course, if you want to see it, you kind of have to scroll down way, way, way down, but it's there. Or you can check it in the posted photos, and you'll see it there, too.
Sure.
People just need to look up my name on Facebook and ask to be a friend, and we're very generous with including people in our community.
Well, great. Yeah, it's been a lot of fun. So, thanks again. Like I said, it's been a huge pleasure.
Okay, Andy. All the best to you.
Well, that wraps up this episode. But before we close, I want to address a comment that Greg made kind of early in the interview. Greg mentioned that his goal isn't always necessarily to bring someone to the foot of the cross. He got a chance to explain himself somewhat, but he didn't explain himself quite as thoroughly as he did in the book. So in his defense, knowing that there's probably some criticism that's going to come from that, I'd like to share the more thorough explanation that Greg gives in his book. On page 38, Greg says, "In some circles, there's pressure for Christian ambassadors to close the sale, so to speak. Get right to the meat of the message. Give the simple gospel. If the person doesn't respond, you have still done your part. Shake the dust off your feet and move on. In my view, though, you don't have to get to the foot of the cross in every encounter. You don't have to try to close every deal. I have two reasons for this view. First, not all Christians are good closers. Yes, some are effective at getting the decision. For those with that gift, harvesting takes little effort. Nothing fancy is required. The simple gospel does the trick. Yet I'm convinced that most Christians, including me, are not harvesters. Instead, we are ordinary gardeners, tending the field so others can bring in the crop in due season. Some Christians, aware of their difficulty in harvesting, get discouraged and never get into the field at all. If this describes you, then you need to know it's okay to sow, even if you don't reap. In fact, there'd be no harvest at all without you. Ironically, I think harvesting comes easily for some because many ordinary gardeners preceded them, planting, watering, and weeding, cultivating healthy growth until the fruit was ripe. Here's the second reason that I do not think it wise to make a beeline for the cross in every conversation. In most situations, the fruit is not ripe. The non-believer is simply not ready. She may have just begun to consider Christianity. Dropping a message on her that is, from her point of view, meaningless or simply unbelievable doesn't accomplish anything. In fact, it may be the worst thing you can do. She rejects a message that she just doesn't understand, and then she's harder to reach next time." I think that describes his point of view rather well, and I agree completely. So that wraps up June. Thanks so much for joining me once again. And thanks again to Greg for agreeing to do the interview. It was a lot of fun. I really enjoyed it. So that was June. We'll see you again in July. I'm Andy Olson. This is Echo Zoe Radio.